Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly, up today, the Big Four firing blanks. More nils than a Swedish phone book, that's one of Sean's, with goalless draws for United, Liverpool and Chelsea. While thanks to Man City, things are at Arsenal are like the accommodation in I'm a Celebrity tents. Was it the weather? A top expert reports. Meantime, there's the latest from Italy, Spain and France and previews of the midweek Champions League. All that in a packed to the rafters Football Weekly. Hello there, and welcome back to Kevin McCarra.
Hello, James.
Hi, Kevin, where have you been?
Wandering around football grounds and being away when you're recording the pod. That's disgraceful.
Oh.
That Fabio Capello insisted that I went to Germany last week, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, he needed you more than... No, it's not true, is it?
Not at all.
Not at all. And Sean Ingle's back as well.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Good. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
How are you?
Good.
Excellent.
And you?
I am well as well. That's nice then. I hope you're well, listeners out there in Podland. Remarkable weekend. Go on, Sean, go on.
I'm just noticing you're wearing a really poncy grey scarf, which, when it's warm in here, there's absolutely no need.
Paint the listeners a picture.
Well, I tried.
Poncy and grey. That sums it up.
And it is noted in the Italian manner, isn't it?
It is. It's very classy. And
through the loop. Yep.
But utterly unnecessary. Right, it's okay. Not snowing in here.
Right. Don't stop with me. How about Paul? What's he wearing? Extremely crumpled purple jumper.
Well, I don't iron my jumpers. So.
Right, okay. not sure what you do to them, actually. Sean, on the other hand, is straight from the IT department with this sort of mauve. That's your concession to individuality. You've gone from a slightly mauve tinge to your blue.
This is Agnes B, James.
No.
It is.
That's
really
your old school shirt, isn't it?
My word. And Kevin, you know.
This is Marks and Spencer's, not even the autograph range, it's the cheap stuff, yep.
Really? Okay, yeah. Well, fair enough. We won't start on producer Pete. Now, all the Big Four failed to score for the first time since 1993. Sean, was it the weather?
There's a couple of gambling books that I have, and I don't want to belabor the gambling points. I get savage on the blogs for it. But there is some evidence that when it's particularly hot, often there are more goals scored because teams tire in the last 15, 20 minutes of games. And when there's a cold snap, for some reason, there are fewer goals. I don't know whether the cold snap over the weekend had anything to do with it.
The most prolific weekend in English top flight history was, in fact, a Boxing Day, December the 26th, where I'd suggest it was probably cold. But an average of 6.6 goals.
Wasn't that in the... wasn't that 62-3? And that was the winter... The onset of winter happened, I think, the next day. And then we had an absolutely freezing cold 1963, which it didn't, basically. It didn't play any football at all for a couple of months.
Are you making this up, Sean?
Of course I'm not.
In your big book of gambling tips, you should bring it in, actually. There are one or two other pointers in there as well.
Well, no, everyone seems to think that when the conditions are wet and it's greasy, there are going to be more goals. But according to this book, which had analysed goals over, I think, a 10-year period, when it rains heavily, it's actually a fewer goals. It seems to be that strikers struggle more than defence. That was the argument for it. And also looked into the whole issue of away and home, why teams do so badly away. But that would take weeks and weeks to discuss.
Fascinating,
so I won't go into it.
Fascinating volume it must be. I presume you carry this around with you always.
Could be boring to him point out that teams like Man U, although they score a large number of goals overall, are prone to these days when they struggle a bit. I mean, the start of the season's been 0-0 draw at home.
Yeah.
And I tend to think, you know, Tevez, he loves going deep, very busy, but not in the goal mouth enough. Wayne Rooney, more of a creator. Berbatov, more of a creator. Sometimes you lack that little kind of finishing power in the goal mouth.
I mean, I think, to be honest, when we talk about the weather, and that's, it's by the by, you can really look at each game and say, you know, Villa against United. What surprised me a little bit about Villa was they were so negative. I mean, Martin O'Neill has clearly learned from Brian Clough, who often used to set his teams at home against the big side to actually play on the counter-attack. And that's what Villa did against United. They did it against Liverpool as well. So you can understand why that was a tight game.
I think, too, John Carew wasn't really fully fit. And Villa don't have many alternatives in attack.
This used to be the big problem for Villa, their form against the big four clubs. But that's beginning to change.
Well, that's the first point against United anywhere for since 2002. I mean, they haven't just lost since then. They've absolutely hammered like 3 and 4 goals.
Well, last year it was 8-1 on over the two games.
But Well, Mark Lanier does know what he's doing. He's got an excellent owner in Randy Lerner, who doesn't seem to be exploiting the club in any way. And the better O'Neill does, probably the more inclined he will be to invest. People will know this too, but if you look at Martin O'Neill doing a press conference, you see the board behind him, all the sponsors, one of them being Acorn. Of course, Acorn appears in the club jersey, which is a children's hospice, which is given equal promotion along with all the other brands that we're familiar with. So I think Randy Lerner can be very proud of what he's done at Villa.
They're a feel-good club, aren't they? And not only that, they've got sensible ticketing.
Well, indeed, they were advertising for next week's game with Fulham, two adults and £2 for a total of £40. I don't think you can get into, one person can get into some of the London grounds for £40.
Bloody hell, you couldn't get to the cinema for £40 in West End cinema.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
Hats off to Villa, and Martin Lanier is doing a good job.
I understand sources close to Randy Lerner indicate that he actually has the words Aston Villa tattooed on his ankle. So there you go. That's a commitment that you're unlikely to see Hicks and Gillette repeating.
Just how close are these sources?
Close. Close sources. So just the draw then. Although, yeah, Villa had a fair shout for that that foul on Agbon Lahore by Vidic. The only argument seemed to be whether it occurred inside or outside the area. That one question I had raised, does it matter where the foul begins or where it ends?
No, because the referee can see a playing the advantage until such time as
the player goes down.
The player goes down, and then they give a penalty. After all, the attacking team should get the benefit.
Right.
I must say, to be honest, journalists have this bad habit of watching the replays and then becoming all-knowing. At the time, it didn't occur to me as a penalty. I felt this Vidic being kind of wise, stop fouling when they got to the 18-yard line.
Mm.
And also, it never crossed my mind it was like a goal-scoring opportunity. It seemed to me it was a run from the wing. I'd have been amazed if the referee had shown a straight red. As it was, he gave nothing, which was puzzling, and the linesman was of no help to him. I think the referee initially was quite far off the incident and got no help from his assistant.
Mm. OK, well, United midweek are going to be at Villarreal, with whom they are tied, whilst Alberg and Celtic are going to be having a bit of a playoff for a spot in the UEFA Cup, really. But at Villarreal, it was 0-0, of course, wasn't it, at Old Trafford?
It was.
Yeah, there you go. And they've got the derby next week, Man City, coming up.
Who
are looking quite tasty. Well, they've won two games now in their last nine, as opposed to one in eight.
But 2-0 is quite good.
But they are looking like a Mark Hughes side again, aren't they? A bit of pressure on the opponents.
I think it helped they played at an Arsenal side that were just, they couldn't have been more at sea if they were out, 300 miles out, wherever in the Atlantic Ocean. I think what will worry Wenger is the way the goals were conceded. I mean, the first one was comical. It was pinging around the fence. There was, it was like a schoolboy football goal. The second, there was absolutely no cover in front of the back four. I mean, I've talked before about the great Arsenal sides around the turn of the century. You had Vieira, you had Petit. They were the two guard dogs guarding that back line. There was no one there, and it was very easy to score. Well, it's astonishing. There always used to be, around a decade or so ago, there'd be stories around this time of year saying the French players would have their own Christmas party and the English players would want their own Christmas party, but it never really seems to affect them on the pitch. They seem to be at war with William Gallas, or should it be William Galois? He likes cigarettes. Seeming to having a go at Nasri, having a go at Van Persie, and everything else. And it just seems, Wenger, who is the ultimate, not control freak, but he's very, very good at keeping everything in house and presenting a very smiley face to journalists whenever he sees them, is rattled. And it's the first.
I haven't seen him smiling for a while. I liked his comment after the game, Man City beating them 3-0 on Saturday. He said it was a flattering result. I can only assume he means for Arsenal, because they were taken apart by Man City.
I only saw about 10 minutes of highlights, but I thought Arsenal did okay, then collapsed as soon as they conceded the first goal. I love this thing too about saying we shouldn't talk about players who aren't here. You mean players you chose not to bring? You made it sound as if somehow William Gallas was injured or ill or something,
Apparently the latest on the Gallas in Wonderland business is that he is going to be welcomed back into the team, although he has to apologise first. They have an interesting set of fixtures coming up, Arsenal. They have Dynamo Kiev midweek. A victory there would take the Gunners through to the next round. And Dynamo haven't won in England in 8 previous attempts, for what that's worth. Then Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. At what point do you think does Wenger say, sorry, I'll just put the Carling Cup youth team out? Because they do at least seem to have a bit of vim and spark about them, don't they?
Not against Chelsea.
No.
I think, too, James, the thing is that Arsenal do perfectly all right against big teams.
Yeah.
Beat Manchester United very impressively.
Right. Chelsea continue to drop points at home. That's 9 already they've shed at their previously impenetrable Stamford Bridge fortress.
It is. It was a big surprise. Well done to Newcastle. But what I think is interesting is a really good piece by Kevin Pullane, who's a football writer at the Racing Post today. He talks about it's not what the teams do at home that often determines if they win the league or not. It's how they do away.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's people can look at it, but basically Chelsea over the last 4 years had 188 points at home. Liverpool had 176, so not that much of a gap. But Chelsea away had 166. Liverpool 108 only, so much bigger difference. Mm. Chelsea are very, very good. Picking up those away wins.
Well, there will perfect
be the,
record.
There will be the odd draw now and again, but they'll do that, and their rivals aren't as good at the moment.
It's system two, doesn't it? I mean, they get more space in the away games, and you see that in an Elka scoring record, quite weak at Stamford Bridge, very strong in the away games.
Mm. Well, they certainly missed some chances this weekend against Newcastle, though well done, as you say, to Newcastle. Chelsea, interesting in the Champions League because they're top of their group still, but only by 1 point ahead of Roma, who are playing Cluj on 4 points, and Roma are tied on 6 points with Bordeaux. Now, Bordeaux are hosting Chelsea this midweek. Paul Doyle, they've won two straight, I think, haven't they, Bordeaux, in the Champions League?
In the Champions League, yeah. They're back-to-back wins over Cluj.
Right.
but they're on a poor run of form in the league. They only drew at the weekend, and they've only picked up 4 and 4, I think, and they're not playing well. They're having trouble scoring goals in particular. In the league, Fernando Cavanaghi, the Argentinian, is the only one who scores for them, but he hasn't found a net in the Champions League yet, where their creativity all comes from Yohan Gourcuff, who is a very good player. And he could open the Chelsea defence. But as I said, I think last time, Bordeaux are very vulnerable on the flanks. In particular, their fullbacks are quite error-prone, and you'd imagine that Chelsea will target that. And I can't see Bordeaux keeping a clean sheet against Chelsea.
Just remind me again, Paul, was it 4-0 when they played at Stamford Bridge?
It was 4-0.
4-0, yes. Right. So, okay, so Chelsea would have some reason to be optimistic about their chances there. Moving along then, Liverpool held goalless by Fulham. They missed Steven Gerrard. And Rafa Benitez, is this him going back to his old ways, leaving Xavi Alonso on the bench, despite the fact that Gerrard was out? He left his Spanish playmaker there on the bench instead of putting him on because presumably he was worried about the upcoming Champions League game against Marseille.
And also he thought he could afford it, obviously. We'll win the game regardless, must have been the thought he had in mind. But Torres, Sunday, you thought might have flourished in that game, but...
Didn't. Robbie Keane, someone who... you might have thought wouldn't have flourished in that game, didn't. And still not really catching fire, is it, that partnership?
I mean, how many goals has he scored this season? Less than...
two, I think.
Which is less than Berbatov, less than all the other strikers Spurs have got rid of, less than Darren Bent,
Less than Andy Johnson.
Less than Andy Johnson. He's taken a while to warm up.
Mm, indeed so. Liverpool taking on Marseille. They're all but safely through, but they're level with Atletico Madrid, who are taking on PSV Eindhoven this week. And again, to win the group, they need a good result there.
Although a draw would probably suffice, they should go for a win there because Marseille at the back at the moment are absolutely wretched.
Are they?
I mean, Lille, they drew 2-2 at home at the weekend.
Have they got Tyrone Mears there at Marseille?
No, that I don't think that ever materialised.
No, he's there.
He is
there. Yeah. I don't think he's playing.
Played,
he's been injured. Yeah. That's yes, that'll only help matters. Right, okay, there you go. In other news, Spurs continue to shoot up the table like a short-sighted gunslinger, as the old saying has it, with that victory. You want to say something?
No, I was just saying, your mate, Paul Ince, he was telling me earlier, he never answers your calls anymore, never returns your calls. But he's struggling, isn't he, at Blackburn?
He is struggling.
If he spoke to you, he'd chill out, wouldn't he? And
he'd feel more mellow instead of having a pop at poor old Joe Jordan,
He's got to answer that phone. Chums. It's the only answer he's got to answer the phone.
Right, yeah. No, it's not as if I've barraged him with phone calls, but I did send him a text, which he didn't necessarily return.
He might have changed numbers.
I don't think so.
I seem very definite.
It's not that interesting a story, Sean. I tell you what we'll do is we'll do an experiment. I will send him a text and saying chin up, yeah? And then we'll see if he responds. And listeners, answers next week, okay? It is a dramatic situation there for Blackburn. They have now gone 8 games without a win, as I need hardly remind you. And there they are in penultimate place. Who are the bottom three? It's Wigan, who are going to play this evening, then Blackburn, then West Brom. Any word on the Spurs-Blackburn defeat? Ooh, Gareth Bale, this will be in your big book of betting tips. Gareth Bale, the curse of Bale continues. He was an unused sub this weekend, which is important, Sean, because?
Well, he hasn't played when Spurs have won the season. But I mean,
ever. Since ever. They bought him, he has never played in a league match when they've won. Isn't that amazing? Because he's a good player.
It was amazing when I heard it several weeks ago. But it interests me about Ince, because a lot of the Blackburn fans begin to turn on him, which I think is perhaps slightly premature, because they got rid of Bentley in the summer. They haven't really had Santa Cruz and McCarthy playing together very often.
Well, he doesn't want to play Benny McCarthy with Santa Cruz.
But Santa Cruz has had a few injuries as well this season, in fairness.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He's lost Stephen Reid for the season.
So the flair that I think Blackburn had last season, didn't have much of it, but it came from those three players. Two of them gone, one of them's been injured. So I think it's perhaps a little early to judge Ince.
Before the season even started, they were already gunning for him, don't they?
Well, it's a classic thing. It's a big jump in leagues. Mm. And then, of course, you're going to a club which has overperformed under a manager who's just left, and you're trying to pick up the pieces. I feel a bit sorry for him. They haven't been cut adrift. I think it's a bit early to start sort of despairing of them.
Mm, indeed so, although you don't think the future looks that rosy with a lot of the talk of Santa Cruz moving on in January, etc.
No, you have to find, as Hugh said, bargains with the money you get for Santa Cruz. But the signings that Blackburn made were very, very good previously.
They certainly were. Anything else on the weekend? I mean, Portsmouth, fantastic goal from Glenn Johnson. Says Sean Ingle. You appreciated that one, didn't you?
If Ronaldo or anyone else hadn't been scoring about that, that would have been the first thing on the pod. We would have been purring about it from now to Christmas. But yeah. It was a great goal.
All right. Well, we'll talk maybe more about Portsmouth later on when we can address the issue of their upcoming UEFA Cup game with Milan. Ooh. Rossoneri at Fratton Park. Magnificent. But now it's time for a little musical jinglelet or something, after which we will hopefully have Sid Lowe on the line.
Football Weekly with James Richardson on guardian.co.uk.
Right, now if you've got any comments, etc., or questions or that kind of thing, do get in touch with us via the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk, and then it says Football Weekly on the football masthead. All very easy. Or you can find us over on Facebook, where membership is now over 3,000. And lots of people getting in touch with us there. Sid Lowe, you're always a popular man with the posters, Sid. And you've got plenty to tell us about this week. Now, let me see. You were talking about Sevilla-Valencia last week. That was 0-0 and very disappointing.
Yeah, it's typical, isn't it? It was supposed to be the first game of this run of really great games, and it was dreadful. I think the player that had the ball most during the game was a Valencia goalkeeper, Renan. And it wasn't because he wasn't saving lots of shots. It was because Valencia reminded me a little bit of what Liverpool used to do occasionally. Back in the days when there was no back pass rule. And if they ever got in any doubt, it didn't matter where they were on the pitch, they'd turn around and thump it back to the goalkeeper 50 yards. Valencia were really awful. I think it was really summed up by the fact that both coaches after the game said, oh yeah, point's a good result. And unfortunately, I think that revealed the fact that they both went into the game with exactly that attitude.
Right, 0-0. Was it very cold in Seville, I'm wondering?
No, but not as far as I'm aware. I wasn't there. I watched that one on the television.
Right, oh, okay. Now, Barcelona, meanwhile, the big surprise after scoring, what was it, about 12 goals at home in the last three fixtures there at the Nou Camp, they've got held to a draw by Getafe.
Yeah, as you say, it was two sixes and a four, I think, their last three home games. And Getafe did hold them. I think the problematic thing for Barcelona is that it raises one or two questions. The first one is, hang on a minute, have clubs started to realise, like they did a couple of seasons ago, that you sit very, very deep and you make it difficult for Barcelona? And the second one is, given that, does that mean that Barcelona really can't live without Leo Messi and Andres Iniesta? And I think there's some truth to that, because those two are players that, particularly when other teams are very defensive and very tight, that they, you know, they're the players that can perhaps unlock them. That said, I don't think you can really criticise Barcelona too much, because I thought they did absolutely everything you could pretty much ask them to do. Pep Guardiola's changes were good as well. He did the right things in terms of trying to get back into the game. Thierry Henry made a real impact, but in the end it just wasn't enough, and Barcelona got done on a break early in the half, but Getafe played very well indeed.
So, Sid, I was watching on TV, and the one thing I would say in Barcelona's favour was that they equalised for a most un-Barcelona-like goal. So at least they had a bit of variety, a defensive midfield player coming in and scoring for a header, you know. It's the last thing I expected to see, but it's good to have a plan B, isn't it?
it is good to have a plan B, and it's something the Barca haven't had over the last few years. And I think that you're right. I think that's very important, particularly Dani Alves when he goes up and down the right wing. It's something that Pep Guardiola has clearly said to him that he wants Alves to cross early. Cyril Alves used to burst into the penalty area. He crosses a lot earlier than he used to. His cross was headed in by Seydou Keita. And it's interesting as well that Guardiola is asking Keita to bomb up and down the pitch and not be an orthodox defensive midfielder, which to some extent he was at Sevilla, although he had what the Spaniards describe as recorrido and llegada. He did get into the area. He did make those kind of old David Platt-style runs, if you like. But that's really important for them. And also, I think...
What's a David Platt-style run? Because I always thought one of the singular characteristics of the Plattmeister was the fact that he ran like a chicken, basically, with his arms waving out on either side.
Oh yeah, no, he ran in a deeply anaesthetic sort of way, yeah. But it was quite effective in the Platt's key characteristic, I would probably argue, when he played, was that he would get into the box just behind the strikers and arrive from deeper to right. score goals. And I think that's what they're trying to get out of Seydou Keita at Barcelona. It's also, to some extent, what they've been getting out of Xavi Hernandez this year, that he's been playing further up and trying to bomb beyond Samuel Eto'o and make things happen. He actually didn't play very well. But also, Barca were very bold. I mean, they finished the game with Dani Alves at right back, and Dani Alves is anything but a right back. He was right winger, right midfield, bursting through the middle, trying to go up front. And Seydou Keita, this marauding midfielder, ended up at left back as they just threw absolutely everything at them. And as I say, the in terms of individual performances, Thierry Henry came on and made a real difference. And Bojan Krstić, you know, this kid that we've all been getting very excited about, was absolutely awful again. And I have to say that I think if this goes on very much longer, then we're going to have to say this kid's not going to make it.
He looked terminally depressed on the bench afterwards. Did you see the pictures of him?
Yeah. He was on the bench and he was crying. Bear in mind, this is a guy that's been caught. Yep, this is a guy that's been called up three times, I think, for the Spain squad before he actually made his debut. On one of those occasions, he felt dizzy and sick. It was clearly the anxiety getting to him. He pulled out of the Spain squad for the European Championships because he said he wasn't emotionally and physically ready for it. And this is a kid that you think, well, all right, of course there's pressure, and of course it's difficult, and of course he could come good because he's still very young.
He's 17, though.
He's 17, but you do feel to yourself that, you know, the really great players also have mental toughness. They're also capable of dealing with it, capable of living with the pressure. And I hate to say this because he's very talented, but I've seen him this year, and the few times he's done anything good, it's been really striking, because mostly he's been pretty poor, and more than anything else, he's looked weak.
Well, Sid, I feel terrible for the poor kid. He's 17 years old. He's being pushed by some giant multinational club.
Exactly.
Everyone needs to step back and give him...
I'm not for one minute questioning the if you like, the moral stance of it, or whether or not we should be on his back, and I don't think we should be on his back for a minute. But, of course, the kids that really do make the impact tend to be the ones that can deal with it. And the worrying sign is that maybe he can't.
Yeah.
And that could be genuinely problematic for him, because he's got talent, there's no doubt about it, although personally I don't like him playing in a wide attacking position, which is where he was playing this weekend. But... you know, Spain gave his first Spain debut, for example. I was at the game in Albacete. Every time he got the ball, it was like his legs had been put on the wrong way around. He was just falling over it, and you could tell that it was just emotion, the emotion, the anxiety of it. He really couldn't deal with this. And now that's not to say, as I say, that he might not come through this, but there is a sense that he's maybe just not quite emotionally and psychologically cut out for it.
Okay, they're at Sporting Lisbon midweek. Villarreal lost. That's their first defeat of the season. They're at home to Man United. Atletico Madrid are taking on PSV in the Champions League. They are tied.
It's an empty stadium as well, of course.
Oh, yeah, fair point. How long is their ban for, stadium ban?
Just the one game. They went to the Supreme Sports Tribunal, or whatever the hell you call it, last week. And quite amusingly, they went there with Florin Cinema-Pongol, because, of course, they were trying to say, we're not a racist club. And Florin Cinema-Pongol gave evidence and said, I've never had any problems at the Calderon. The fans are great. It's not a racist club at all. This is the same Florin Cinema-Pongol who last year, playing for Recreativo, had the Atletico Madrid fans oohing him and said after the game, it's very sad that things like this should happen here.
My word.
So he's forgotten in rather a hurry.
That's extraordinary. Listen, finally, Sid, Real Madrid... crisis team Real Madrid, now just 3 points behind Barca again at the top. They were the only one of the big clubs to win, yeah?
It's funny, isn't it? Top six, and the only club that won this weekend was the club in crisis. And you know what? I might even be cruel enough to go so far as to say that the club that won this weekend of the top six was the club that played the worst of the top six as well. Real Madrid won 1-0 against second bottom Recreativo. They had another goal disallowed, so they could maybe argue it should have been two, but they also had a blatant penalty not given to Recre. And Madrid were dreadful yet again, but they keep on winning. You know, this is now, I think, the seventh of nine games that they've won by a single goal. And I think for Barcelona, it must, in a way, be kind of demoralising that, you know, week after week they played brilliantly. Week after week, Real Madrid played pretty rubbish, to be perfectly honest. They've only had a couple of genuinely good performances, and yet Barcelona just cannot shake them off. Do you know, Real Madrid are now the club in Europe with more injuries than any other in the top flight in any league in Europe.
My word. Juve've got one or two injuries, and the reason I mention that is because you got Real Madrid there at Bati. I don't know. If they only get a draw there, Zenit St. Petersburg are hosting Juve this week. Juve, who are an Italian side, they're already qualified for the next round and therefore unlikely to bust a gut over that fixture. They've got Thiago out, which means they've got absolutely nobody of any creative ability available in midfield. If Zenit win that game, which is entirely possible, I think that Real Madrid could find themselves in a very nasty situation going into the final round of Champions League games.
Can I turn the tables, James, on our normal roles here and ask you a question?
Go on.
Are Juventus, given that they're already through and given the absentees and so on, are they cynical enough or clever enough, depending on how you want to look at it, to let themselves be beaten in that game to try and get rid of Real Madrid this early?
Sid. As I say, Juve are an Italian side. Seek your answers in that nugget of information. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think given that it's away in Russia and given that they're facing a bit of a battle towards the top of the Italian table and the fact they're already through, they are really going to make this game not on their priority list. And we all know what happens when Italian teams don't make a game a priority. Sid, I hope that's answered your question. You certainly answered ours in fine style. Many, many, many thanks. And we look forward to speaking to you on Thursday.
Yeah, brilliant. Speak to you then. Cheers.
Thanks, Sid.
Bye.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Paul Doyle. We've got exciting news of Ligue 1 with Lyon, the leaders, losing to PSG. Two questions. First, are PSG any good these days? And secondly, does that make it tight again at the top in France?
It's not terribly tight, no, and that's one of the disappointments of the season. Lyon haven't been particularly good this season and others have failed to capitalise on that. However, PSG, on the plus side, they are starting to look good. Paul again finally seems to have hit upon a winning formula. You remember last year, at one point he was throwing in a load of teenagers, almost out of desperation, into the first team and hoping to hit upon something. This year they've brought in the likes of Makélélé and Ludovic Juli. They've got up front they have Guillaume Auro, who they bought from Lav. He was the top scorer in Division 2 last season. And they have a genuinely solid shape. They're not particularly good to watch. It's all about getting loads of men behind the ball and then getting it quickly up to Auro and Juli to hit on the break. But sometimes through Stéphane Cessignon, actually, who was another one of their summer signings, and who's very much like, if you remember when Leverkusen got to the Champions League final with Bastruk, the Turkish guy, he's a very similar type of player, this guy. And they've now beaten Lyon, Marseille and Bordeaux this season. Ooh. And are up to fifth place. And although they're still saying that, which is incredible really, that their priority this season is to avoid relegation. But there's a chance that they might sneak in with everyone else performing so miserably.
I take it's all sweetness and light now with the fans after all the turmoil the past few years?
It hasn't been entirely forgiven. It's only a mini run, but he started to become consistent, and you can now actually see a method. You can see what he's doing. Beforehand, we didn't know what it was, and it was only his perceived friendship with the people above him that kept him in his job. But now he seems to have learned, basically, which is what they always said would happen. He would learn and he'd get it right eventually. And the signs are he seems to have got it right.
Magnificent.
One thing I think quite interesting, if you looked at the German league this week, there were goals every single game, more than three goals. Looked at the French league, by contrast, almost no goals whatsoever. I think only one or two games, I think, had more than three goals in. Lots of nil-nils, one-nils, very low scoring again in France. And I know not so long ago they had a...
But statistically, if you look back over the last 5 years or so, Bundesliga is the top scoring league.
Of course it is, and France is the lowest. But a couple of years ago, they commissioned the guy who was the France manager in 1984.
Yeah, Michel Hidalgo.
To have a look and to kind of throw up ways of making Ligue 1 more interesting, but nothing seems to have come from it.
What did he do? Tighter shorts, was it?
No, he had these things like bonus points for winning by more than three goals, this sort of thing he was suggesting. But no, it's still the problem is most teams, when they go away, they play 4-5-1. And Lille were an exception this weekend because they went to Marseille. Originally, the team she suggested they were going to play 4-5-1. They saw Marseille's team. They were fielding some very dodgy defenders. And he said, saw this, we'll go on the attack. They went on the attack. They were 2-0 up. Now, eventually, Marseille managed to haul it back to 2-2. But it showed that if you do go out and attack... it'll be more entertaining.
Right, the thing is, Paul, I mean, most teams play with one outright forward nowadays, don't they? I mean, there's very few teams play two real forwards pushed right up the pitch, do they? You know,
well, that's true, yeah.
So but are the five especially dull in the 4-5-1 that French teams play?
Yeah,
they're all defensive, is that the...
Absolutely. Even Marseille had their three holding midfielders at home on Saturday.
What a spectacle.
I know.
I tell you what, let's hear about the exciting free-scoring world of Serie A, shall we? Paolo Bandini standing by while we just do our business with the airlocks. Producer Pete, a jingle, please. Joining us here, Paolo Bandini. Didn't I say Inter Juve would be rubbish, Paolo?
You said it would be rubbish, but yeah. I'm not convinced it was rubbish. Jimbo.
No, okay.
No, I thought it was quite an enjoyable game. It was very one sided. Inter absolutely played Juventus off the park pretty much from start to finish. But I thought that Inter did some nice stuff. Or Ibrahimovic, who has been slated because he did miss some absolute sitters, but he played really well actually. I mean, he really sort of took the game to Juventus. He obviously really was motivated for it. I suppose I should have started from the beginning. I mean, Mourinho basically sprang this big surprise by putting Adriano back in the team. He hasn't played since October. And actually, there are a few other surprises. I mean, Materazzi started in defence. He hasn't started in the league in defence since September. But Adriano was sort
Montari
of this big...
Montari for Vieira as well, no?
I don't know if it was so much Montari for Vieira because Montari was already starting. But I mean, sort of Stankovic came in and played ahead of the midfield. And then you had Montari, Cambiasso and Zanetti sort of in this bank of three. I mean, I think Zanetti was the one who the press was sort of surprised got in instead of Vieira. But the real surprise was Adriano because, he's been talking about, I'm not sure I'm happy here anymore and generally being the difficult character that he is and hasn't been playing much. And it seems like he hasn't been particularly, doing the sort of things that please Mourinho. But he came on and he put in an absolute, a Dirk Kuyt-esque shift, I guess you would say. He really worked his socks off. Generally made a use of himself, wasn't particularly incisive, but made himself a handful for the defenders. And in the end, the goal, which was a bit fortuitous because basically Adriano sort of bundled two defenders out of the ball, way the ball broke for Ibrahimovic, who scuffed his shot across goal, and then it somehow found its way to Montari, who scuffed it back across goal, and Meninga thought it was offside and it rolled in. It was he did a job, and I think it really sort of caught Ranieri off guard as well, because a lot of people were sort of expecting him to go with just Ibrahimovic alone up front, and he came with two strikers and the infamous rhombus midfield that we were talking about last week.
Yeah, indeed, the rhombus. They are now 3 points clear of Milan, who were held to a 2-2 draw at Torino late on Sunday. And after Milan, you've got Napoli and Juventus 6 points back from Inter. What else? Now, Fiorentina, huge game for them. 4-2 win against Udinese. Quite a turnaround in that one.
Yeah, it was. I mean, at halftime, Udinese were all over Fiorentina in the first half. I mean, Fiorentina still had a couple of very good chances because basically Udinese weren't defending at all. But, really, in the halftime, you sort of looked at it and you thought that was going to be it. And, halftime... Prandelli brought off Semioli and he brought on Mario Santana, and they basically just started playing a lot better. I don't really know if that was all there was to it, but they absolutely took him apart in the second half. Four goals in the... I can't remember the exact time. It's like
27 minutes.
There you go, 27 minutes. And it was some really nice goals as well.
Fiorentina are hosting Lyon in the Champions League. And they are in real, real trouble. They have to beat Lyon and hope other results go their way. They're 5 points adrift of Lyon and Bayern, who are sharing the league currently in that group. Any chance, do you think, of them?
It's difficult. I mean, I've seen Fiorentina a few times this season, and they're really up and down. Like, one minute they seem to be playing this beautiful, free-flowing football, and the next minute they... I mean, I do think they have problems at the back that they just haven't resolved, but they just seem to sort of get in a funk, and suddenly they can't create anything. I mean, when Mutu and Gilardino are playing well together up front, that's actually, a very potent strike force, and they've done very well. I mean, I think they were hurt at the beginning of the group stage, the beginning of the league season as well, because Mutu was out for a long while, and they've been better since he's come back, but they're still sort of... they're not consistent. And I think even, in that game against Munich in the last round, they sort of at one point looked like they were going to stroll away with it, and it's happened in the first time they played Lyon, and they just both times have managed to shoot themselves in the foot.
lack that killer edge.
It should be quite an entertaining game, actually, yep. because, as you say, Fiorentina have to win, and Lyon have severe defensive problems at the moment, mainly because of injury, and they lost in the defeat against PSG at the weekend. Their one stalwart, who's performed consistently well for them this season, right back Anthony Reveillère, got injured, and he's out possibly for the rest of the season. And they will probably have to do what they ended up doing against Steaua Bucharest when did they win 6-3 or was it 5-4 or something? Can't remember now. But which will just rely on the likes of Benzema, who missed the PSG match, and try and outscore Fiorentina. So it could be fun.
There you go. Roma up to 14th place. They have a goal in game in hand, rather. And Francesco Totti back and banging. That's two.
Do you know? I thought this was the most fun story. Was that everyone's talking about Totti just because he scored a chip, and this is the sign that all is well with Roma again. It's because Totti scored a chip, which, you know,
it was a nice goal.
It was a nice goal.
It was like Robinho's. You know, Robinho's for against Arsenal. It was like that. They've got a game in hand, which is the game against Sampdoria, which got called off because of heavy rain. Sampdoria, meanwhile, had a big win over Catania. Cassano continuing to shine. Young Antonio Cassano set up the first, scored the next.
And captaining Sampdoria while he's at it.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, I think that's just because Angelo Palombo is out at the moment. Oh. I think, you know, he was sort of taking over the role because it was Sergio Volpi last season, but he's gone to Bologna now. So I think that Cassano's filling in. But
and do you think settling down has made a difference? I mean, there was more talk of, you know, he's talked about his 700 women he slept with, and he's now talked, he's only actually ever had three or four girlfriends. And he said it was easy at Real Madrid because he was in a hotel room all the time, and they seem to be delivered the women with
with the donuts.
With the donuts, and he'd make love to a beautiful woman and then eat some donuts, and it was his perfect day. And I wondered whether perhaps that wasn't the best way to approach a football match, and now he's settled down, Paolo, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they've given him more and more responsibility since he's got back to Sampdoria as well, and I think he's responded well to Walter Mazzarri. I mean, at the same time, actually, he had a bit of a dry spell this season. I mean, he scored 5 goals now, but he scored 3 of them in the last 2 games. I mean, really, he wasn't sort of setting the world on like the beginning of the season. To be fair, neither was Sampdoria generally. I mean, they've sort of come a lot better in the last few weeks. I think the thing with Cassano is, you know, you still sort of, even when he's at his best moments, he's never in the past been more than, you know, one bad incident away from having a massive tantrum, so I wouldn't count on that not happening before the season's out.
Well, look, I'll drag you back to Inter for a minute. Aren't Inter any better under Mourinho than they were under Mancini? And basically, he has to win the Champions League, doesn't he? Because after all, winning Serie A is nothing to Inter in the past few years.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought this was an interesting game in terms of significance, just sort of something that people might hold up, because actually, Mancini in the league never beat Juventus at home. So that is something that, you know, now Mourinho can hold up and say, well, I've done this.
Last 3 games for Inter in the league, Udinese, away to Palermo and Juventus. They won all 3, scored 4, haven't conceded a single goal. So that's pretty impressive. Down at the other end of the table, Chievo are looking like they're heading back down, unfortunately. Certainly the way things are going at the moment, 6 straight defeats. They've already fired one manager. The second is probably soon to follow. They haven't scored for 439 minutes, however many games that is. But that aside, I just wanted to ask quickly about a game that's going to be coming up after our next podcast, but only just at Thursday's Portsmouth Milan game, which is a game which really fires the imagination, doesn't it? What?
Well, it does, but apparently not among Portsmouth. I mean, Tony Adams is hinting that he's going to play a weakened side, so they've got a big relegation clash next Sunday or Saturday against Blackburn, I think. And he's talked about maybe fielding a weakened team, which is sort of stupid because you qualify for the UEFA Cup, you've got a big team against Milan. So a big game against Milan, and yet you play for your reserves.
So David James is very excited, judging by his Observer column at the weekend. He paints a great picture of the kind of Milan and their entourage arriving at Fratton Park and trying to get 50 bodies inside the dressing room that only holds about 11 at most. You know, so and that's the contrast of the slick Milan and the kind of somewhat antiquated stadium at Fratton Park is delightful, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Richard Hughes was giving Satanta's cameras a tour around it the other day. I was, no hair dryers. Where are the hair dryers?
You wouldn't have to worry about that, James.
No, I wouldn't have to worry about it. But Maldini, what's he going to do?
I mean, so Fratton Park's a brilliant place. It'd be a terrible tip. When it gets demolished one day, it'll be very, very sad.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the Milan players are all looking forward to that because it's the kind of atmosphere they're not going to find in Serie A.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And to be honest with you, though, I do think that if Portsmouth don't take it seriously, I think, you know, Milan always take Europe seriously, and I think they'll find that they probably will get taken apart because, I mean, well, Milan have been up and down this season. They did only draw 2-2 this weekend, but going forward, they're still basically very dangerous. They basically sort of shot themselves in the foot horribly this week because they had Kaladze handballed in the area. But there's been, all the papers seem to think this was a terrible decision. I've looked at it, and it seems to me like, you know, he does divert the ball quite significantly on a cross that's going into the six-yard box, and that can't happen. The flip side of that is they should have had a penalty at the other end a little bit earlier, but Ronaldinho scored another fantastic free kick, and he's, you know, he's scoring a lot of goals.
Six goals?
Yeah.
There you go. Well, magnificent. Thanks, Paolo. Yeah, it's all been very continental today, but we'll just have a final bit of news from Little Charlton before we wrap up today. And that is, of course, as you know, Alan Pardew leaving the club by mutual consent after their 5-2 drubbing by Sheffield United. Are things only going to get worse there? They're, what, £20 million in debt?
They are, and they're third from bottom. I think it was no great surprise. Pardew, as a man manager, can rub people up the wrong way. He has a big thing about positive thinking. He'll hang things up in his dressing room that will say, you know, five crosses into the box equals 2.6% more goals. And he's very much into that. People that I've spoken to in the past say he's more Alan Partridge than Alan Pardew as a bloke. He's very loves himself. But we shouldn't feel too sorry for him, because apparently he's going to get a £1 million payoff within the next 12 days for leaving. So, you know, good work if you get it.
How can he be more Alan Partridge than Alan Pardew? He is
Alan Pardew.
That is what Alan Pardew is.
Yeah. On that note, we'll be back on Thursday. I hope you're all well in the meantime. Many, many thanks to Kevin, to Sean, to Paolo and Paul and producer Pete. And do join us on Facebook or on The Guardian's website to post in your comments, complaints, etc. Stop pretending to be Barry Glendinning's friend, because that's a pretty likely story anyone who's ever met Barry Glendinning. And we'll speak to you soon.